I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to Nothing Concrete, the Barbican podcast. I'm Ben Eshmade, and this week we celebrate director Ben Wheatley through his dystopian film High Rise and its follow-up, the pulp gangster thriller Free Fire.
I think cult director is a kind of a polite way of saying it, someone who's made films that not many people have seen, and that's absolutely a fact, so I can't really get upset about it.
As is very appropriate for a podcast from the Barbican, let's begin by entering the brutalist daydream of cult British author J.G. Ballard's book High Rise. In this film adaptation by Ben Wheatley, we follow Dr. Robert Lang, played by Tom Hiddleston, a new resident to a utopian tower block. He is befriended by neighbours such as Charlotte Melville, played by Sienna Miller, and Helen Wilder, played by Elizabeth Moss, with the most overbearing residents being the architect of the project, played by Jeremy Irons, and his wife, played by Keely Hawes.
Who are you?
Did you invite him?
Of course not. No, Royal did, actually. I hope you don't mind.
Must be one of his funny little social experiments.
What have you come as?
A dilettante?
As the drama develops, everything and everyone begins to run out of control. I caught up with the director in an editing suite in Soho to discover more about his dystopian vision.
What made you want to bring this iconic writer's vision to the screen?
It's a book that I'd really liked when I was a kid. And it's one of those books that, I don't know, you kind of read when you're like 15, 16, and it's part of that kind of entry into the world of the counterculture and taking drugs and listening to rock and roll and all that kind of stuff. So I'd read it along with like Naked Lunch and I shouldn't say Naked Lunch and, because it sounds like Naked Luncheon, doesn't it? Which is not what that book is about. But so I'd read it then and I think at the time I was probably more interested in the kind of chaos and anarchy of it. But when I came back to it as an adult, it had different meanings, you know, and it was amazing how prescient it was and how it fitted with, you know. I mean, this is the danger of Ballard, is that he's writing predictive science fiction, and if you live long enough, you manage to see it come true, which is unfortunate, you know, and it seemed to become even more relevant now than it's ever been.
If I had to sort of like sum up the story very quickly, a tower block having a nervous breakdown, would you agree?
Yeah, or a country, or a man, or a woman, you know, I think it works on lots of different levels in that respect from what he's structuring it. But it's certainly not a kind of an essay on post-war architecture.
No.
I'm so sorry. Sorry.
I'll survive.
I don't doubt it. You're an excellent specimen. I thought you were empty.
I just moved in.
I'm Charlotte Melville.
Hi. Sorry, I must have fallen asleep.
You know, I was really lucky to get that kind of large cast and with that pedigree and kind of cultural heft as much as anything, you know.
I was interested to read that this was filmed in Bangor in Belfast. I imagined you would have found somewhere derelict around London or somewhere else, Milton Keynes or somewhere like that. What took you there?
I mean, shooting in places that are fucked is quite dangerous, you know, just on a dull health and safety level. So you can't really film in a ruined place. You have to and all the ruinedness of in the film is art department. It's, you know, because as soon as and this is the problem we had with the actual 70s brutalist buildings, is that they've got they're all full of asbestos, so you really can't go to ones that are damaged because you'll kill the crew and no one wants that, you know. And we looked up and down the country, we just couldn't find anywhere in England. And we looked at Birmingham Library, which was as close as we got to a really amazing brutalist building, and which was closed down at the time. And they kind of wouldn't even let us in it, and then they knocked it down. So we were really lucky in the end when we got to Bangor, because it had the sports centre, which was built in 73, I think, and had been. And the other problem with kind of brutalist stuff is that it all got kind of rehabilitated in the 80s. So there were lots of it got covered in nasty marble and kind of like atriums put on it and all that kind of 80s stuff. So there isn't a lot of places that are untouched. Or if they were really brilliant, like Barbican, they're in full use and they don't appreciate, like, you know, it would be a big stretch for them to accommodate a film crew and then a film crew that was then going to turn the place upside down as well. So, yeah, in the end, we found this sports centre, which wasn't being used. They'd already built a new one in Bangor, which was really swanky and beautiful. So everyone was going to that. And it was next to a police station, so it never got vandalised or ruined. And it was like a time capsule. It was fantastic.
Going back to the actors, what sort of direction did you give Tom Hiddleston? I mean, his character has to have this breakdown alongside the building.
Well, with Tom, it's like he does a massive amount of research from, you know, reading tons about Ballard and reading Ballard and watching movies around it. And then also, I mean, he went to an autopsy and, you know, kind of, which I wouldn't do, to be honest. You know? And they offered it. And I was like, yeah, you know what? I don't fancy that. What's seen can never be unseen, you know. So and then just general conversations around it. But on the day, it's not a lot. I don't tend to kind of really get into it. I'm not that kind of a director who acts stuff out or anything. So it's more, there's been a lot of discussion beforehand. And then it's just monitoring the performance and kind of just giving him feedback to where he is in his arc of his breakdown, or, you know, higher or lower level. That's usually what all I do. I mean, it's not, I think by that point it gets too complicated. And also, you know, I do it from my own experience, which is, you know, if you're lost in the street and you ask someone for direction and they say it's down there, it's on the left, you see a big red house, you go forward, then you'll see there's like an old petrol station, you go left at the petrol station. Can't remember any of that shit, you know. I can remember the first bit of direction, but the rest of it's just lost in the wind, you know. And I feel that's probably possibly true with actors as well, as if you talk too much, it's just, you know, people can only remember the first two things you say. So I think that's just keep it clear and simple, you know. Yeah, I mean, I do give them direction, but it's just light direction. And I think that's the clues in the name. It's direction, it's not telling, you know. And so, but yeah, I think environment is really important, and how everyone feels on set. And also that there's to foster this kind of feeling of experimentation where there's no, I think that's the most important thing for me with performance, is trying to make sure that the actors don't feel like they can fail. And you just let them go, and then they can do their thing. And if it's not quite working with where it needs to be, then there's just subtle, just gentle conversation about it. So, and then, because it's all confidence, I think, this stuff. And the more confident the actors are, the better their performances are, you know.
Ah, Dr. Lang, I hear you play squash.
Yes, I do. You built all this.
Dreamt, conceived. I hardly roll my sleeves up. Of course. Project's far from finished. Over five tires and all, circling the lake. Something like an open hand. The lake is the palm, and we stand on the distal phalanx of the index finger. There.
I was told once that architects have a god complex. This definitely seems to be the case with Jeremy Irons' character, Anthony Royal. You know, at the top of the building, the top person, and ultimately responsible maybe for what goes wrong.
I think that's true, and it's the kind of the arrogance of man, isn't it? And, you know, plans of mice and men, these things don't necessarily come together in the way that you'd hope. I mean, he has, you know, he's kind of a broad thinker, Royal, because he's kind of made this place, and he says it's like a crucible for change, but he hasn't really considered what the change will be and which bit of the change is positive and which is negative, and he's just kind of rolling with it, which I quite like about him. You know, he's quite open to ideas and ready to very quickly resketch his goals. What was it called? Was it in computer programming, when things become a bug and then they turn it into and they claim it's a feature? I think that's what Royal does a lot, you know.
Yeah, I was seeing echoes in the film of Stanley Kubrick, maybe Clockwork Orange in a more literal sense. Was that a direct reference, or just someone that's very much part of who you are as a director?
Yeah, I mean, I think it would I think that there's elements on it that obviously are a nod, which are kind of like the costume stuff, and the costume ball is like, and I can't really pretend that that wasn't, you know. But generally, I don't try to make stuff, I'm not postmodern in that respect of kind of like recreating sequences from other movies. But I think that, yeah, there's a lot of different influences across the film from culture, and some of them may not be from even from film, you know, you get them from television and from comics and literature and stuff. So it's a big old melting pot of stuff, and some of it is, I like, some of it's like cultural echoes, I think, more than references almost. They're more of a it works more in that way for me anyway, but you know, I'm not the one who gets to say.
My car was crushed by a reversing cement truck.
I'm afraid I'm not a physiotherapist.
I know what you are, Dr. Lamb. Constant exercise is the only thing that keeps the pain at bay. So you could say, not only am I the building's first road casualty, but I am the architect of my own accidents. What do you think of that?
How much do you think this film is about darkness? Because, you know, again, we talked about the autopsy and that scene where Tom's character reveals the brain, I found skin-crawlingly revolting. Mm-hmm. But I wondered whether that was something that always seems to bubble up in your work, even if you're not doing a film that's directly in or near that genre.
I think that scene for me is so, you know, obviously he's dealing with that metaphor of like the mask, the face is a mask, but there's also that kind of line where between people being, having humanity and being objects, you know, and I think that's what's really scary about autopsy, because you can literally feel that moment when it happens. I mean, it's a bit like, I don't know, I saw this, what was it? I saw a chat show where a guy was saying, oh, I'm scared of owls, and the host wanted to find at what point he had that fear. So he drew a circle and said, are you afraid of that? No. And he draws a beak on it. He goes, are you afraid of that? And he goes, oh, no, I don't know. And then his round eyes go, oh, I'm feeling uneasy. It's like, wow, that's the moment where it becomes, you know, where you see that thing happen and materialize. And I certainly think that's the case with peeling skin off a face. It's like you go, this was a human. Oh, my God, now it's an object. And how do I deal with that turn that I have, that feeling towards it? But also the fact that, you know, throughout the thing, the behavioural patterns of the people are like the mask that they have to be stripped back, and then they find what's underneath, you know, and but Ballard keeps peeling it back and peeling it back again and again and again to see where they end up.
I mean, doesn't it seem odd, Lang, that a man can fall from the 39th floor and not one police car turn up? Where's the investigation, Lang? I mean, where's the sirens?
I think this is a theme in his books in general, but did you ask the question, why were they left alone? Why didn't the police, the army come and try and sort out this mess, this incredible thing happening?
That's a kind of plot question, isn't it? I mean, it's like there's a question of why don't they leave, I think is more interesting, which is that they kind of enjoy what's going on. Why are they left alone is more of a question for now, isn't it? And kind of ties into the question, why isn't it set in the present day, you know? And I think that we would expect things to be found out more easily now, you know? And I think that there was a secret kept by the people who were in the tower, and they were going to work and they weren't telling, you know? And that could work for Fight Club as equally as it could work for the, why didn't Jimmy Savile get caught till after he was dead, you know? Go ask everyone about that one, you know? Why didn't the police turn up on that, you know? And I think that's a similar kind of thing. It's like they don't want to tell anyone, it's their secret, and they get on with it. But if it was set now, everyone would be taking photographs and put it on Twitter so that everyone would know.
You're described often as a cult film director. I don't know if you're happy with that label. I mean, it doesn't help when you obviously direct things like Doctor Who or do more kind of, you know, maybe genre stuff.
I think cult director is a kind of a polite way of saying it, someone who's made films that not many people have seen. And that's absolutely a fact, so I can't really get upset about it. I mean, and there's two flavours of cult director. There's kind of a person who's making movies at that moment that not many people see, and then there's a proper big cult director is someone who's made massive movies that were a bit poo-pooed at the time and then have been critically rehabilitated later. And I don't think that's where I am at the moment yet. But both could go, you could have the worst of both worlds of films not being seen by many people and then being rehabilitated later, but that'd be fine. No, it doesn't bother me at all. It's good. I mean, anything is good, isn't it?
As this is for the Barbican Film Podcast, you mentioned in passing earlier, was there any, did you look at drawings, like take any inspiration at all from the brutalism of the Barbican?
Absolutely, yeah. The Barbican is an incredible building, and if you really squint in high rise, there is one tiny shot of the Barbican in one of the montages. So, yeah, I mean, of course. I mean, I was there the other day doing an interview and just marvelling at it and just wishing we could have shot there. But I can't imagine for a split second. We'd have had to have hired the whole place out for 7 weeks, closed all down every bit of music and every bit of exhibition and really upset all the residents. So I don't think it would have happened. You know?
I'm just curious, I mean, where are you with your next film, Free Fire? I think that's where you're working at the moment.
We're sitting now in the room in the preview theatre for it and we're in the grading room. So we just watched the final grade, so it's done pretty much. We're just doing the last bits of the sound mix at the moment. So yeah, it should be done in a week and a bit, I think.
Is that a horse?
Probably. My wife rides.
On the 40th floor.
And director Ben Wheatley returned a year or so later with a gang of criminals and one of the longest shootouts in recent cinema history. Free Fire featured a cast that included Brie Larson, Armie Hammer, Cillian Murphy, Sam Riley, Noah Taylor and Michael Smiley. The film has a packed 90-minute runtime that brings together two gangs, one warehouse and an incredible amount of ammunition.
He says it's not what he ordered.
They ordered M16s?
Really? I'm not running a pizza delivery service. You want the weapons or you don't want the weapons?
The director had, previous to High Rise, brought us A Field in England, Sightseers and Kill List. We met up, though, to discuss this 70s set thriller.
You fill up my senses like night in a forest.
What I tend to do is write a lot of scripts, so and there might be all types of kinds of scripts, but we don't get a choice in what we get to make because that's a finance choice, you know, it's what gets traction. So a certain type of film might be easier to finance than another one. So then you might get a certain type of movies in a row like that. Mm. So I think that's more the case. But yeah, but I also like cinema, you know, and I like all sorts of elements of it. And so I write lots of different types of story, or I want to see lots of different types of films. So the script itself moves very quickly through the machine of the industry, you know, in terms of getting actors on board and finance interested. Probably because it's kind of less ambiguous and also doesn't have a really miserable ending, which is like the main problem with most of the films I've made. It's less audience punishing than some of the earlier films.
It's good to meet you boys. Thanks for coming out.
Maybe later.
I'm just saying relax. It's all good. If you wouldn't mind, as we agreed upon, I'll check for wires.
Got a gun.
Good. Well, soon you guys will have even more. Come on, big guy.
You know where I'm from, boy? You'd be halfway up the aisle by now.
I think it's fair to say you revel in the detail. Last night on Twitter, there was this fantastic floor plan of the warehouse or the space that we're in for most of the film. Do you go deep in regards to planning for a film?
Yeah, generally. I mean, I tend to storyboard a lot these days, which I never used to do. But it's because it's a way of like seeing the film for the first time without having to cost that much money. You know, you can meet storyboards halfway and read them and imagine the film much more clearly than if you do it in your head. Well, you could imagine it in your head as well, but you tend to let yourself off a lot of the harder things. So that's why I like to draw it, because it's in your, when you're seeing it in your mind's eye, the stronger, more bolder elements of it come to the front and you get excited. But the smaller things like transitions or things you don't really want to have to think about get kind of pushed to the side, so it can become just the greatest hits. But when you have to draw it, you see it all in all its, you know, horror or glory. So yeah, but a film like this, you can't. Free Fire is not a film that you can wing. You know, it was, because it's in one space. Decisions that you make very early on, you know, you could be shooting, you know, week one. If you don't put the actors in the right place by week six, you're in real trouble. You know, and yeah, you can't get out of it. So it all had to be planned massively. You know, so we built models and we, like, cardboard versions of the set within the empty space and walked it through again and again and again to make sure that it made some kind of sense.
I think we got off on a little bit of a bad footing there, eh? I think what we need to do is just start afresh. So I'm going to be the gentleman in this relationship and I'm going to chuck in a free box of lube because she likes to run wet.
To talk about the film maybe in a little bit more detail, fantastic description I read is the idea of a game of cat and mouse, a very bloody game of cat and mouse.
Yeah, well, I wanted to make something that was very graphic and dynamic and about movement and about spaces. The cat and mouse thing is interesting in regards that I would think about it more like the way that they put together the Tom and Jerry cartoons, you know.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, that's the storyboarding comes into that, but Tom and Jerry is, you know, like a series of goals, missions,
and then the outcomes from those missions. So it's set up like they need to get to here to there, and they get this thing, and then, you know, and you set up various gags, which then you play out through the, or they used to play out on those cartoons. And the same thing with this, it's, there's a level of narrative and a level of dialogue, but there's also a level of physical kind of action and comedy within it as well. So it was built around that.
The title suggests, and it's not giving anything away to say, there's a lot of bullets, a lot of gunfire within the film. But the other thing which you seem to have lots of fun with is the dialogue.
Yeah, I mean, they would, in that situation, be pretty salty with each other. So I wanted to see that and hear that. Once you get over the initial gun battle, it's about the people coming together and alliances being formed and then split apart and betrayals happening and all that. And that's where the drama is, in the meat of it.
Okay, just try not to hit any of the metalwork because I don't want to get any of those bling burns on my new suit.
Sorry, what was that?
This is from Savile Row!
I don't know about you guys, but I for one think Vern's merchandise is a real gas.
My guess is you're whatever you're paid to be, pal.
I was reading the idea of it taking a while for people to die. But I think you did a lot of research, or you had some interest in sort of portraying that as more a real thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, some of the idea of the film had come out of reading transcripts from the FBI about gun battles and being surprised how messy they were in terms of, you know, even people who were trained not being able to hit people who were standing right in front of them, and how actually quite difficult all this stuff is. It's not, you can't, like in a Hollywood movie, you can't just suddenly pick up a gun and fire it. It's like it's like suddenly rushing into a room with a sewing machine and making a pair of trousers if you've never used one before. It's not that easy. I wanted to see that some of that reality in a film. You know, it's like, well, what? It's basically taking something out of a thriller and exploding it. Like a normal thriller, there'd be a gunfight that would be, you know, a couple of minutes long somewhere in it. But what if that gunfight was all there was, you know, and how would that work? I think there's this idea that in cinema that the gun is like a death ray, you know, and it's not. And certainly with pistols, if it's a smaller caliber thing, it's quite difficult, unless people are standing still, to shoot them. To a degree.
Did you try the guns? Have you had any experience of firing a gun?
Yeah. I mean, I fired them all for research purposes. When we were making High Rise, there was we went to a range and shot a lot of those pistols, which is really interesting. It was that, you know, I found that I'm not too bad at shooting targets, but Laurie Rose, the DOP, was not very good. I've got the target to prove that. And I thought that was really interesting, you know, that it's not an innate thing. But then one of the art department guys was just insane. He'd never had a gun in his hand in his life, and it was just, he was like a dead shot. So that was interesting. The actual, it's like holding a firework. It's so terrifying, the actual thing. It's not, doesn't feel him, it's not like, you know, sexy or empowering. It's just like holding a flame in your hand or something, and it's dangerous, you know.
The film, maybe because it's set in the 70s, has a lot of facial hair and testosterone. Brie Larson has quite a hard task as Justine, to be the single female. How did you see her role? How important is she within that crowd?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, I mean, she's very important, and she's kind of interesting to me because she's like Ripley, but she's also like the alien as well in the same film at once. So I kind of like that. Yeah, I mean, and it's that trying to balance that. I didn't want it to become endlessly macho because that becomes boring, you know. So I think that mix has to be there. But it's, and also we were trying to go away from the idea of like the cliches of crime films of gangsters and the mafia and all that kind of stuff. And that's why we did it. You know, but the groups of characters are very mixed, and they're not necessarily who you would have the stock characters for that. For a film like this,
I read that it was made without CGI. It was the 6,000 rounds were all happening in this incredible Brighton warehouse.
Yeah, it was mostly without CG. So, like in a lot of modern films, they tend to just have the guns and they jerk them back, and then they mime them firing basically, and then they put like a flash frame muzzle flash on in CG. But there's something about holding real blank firing guns, which is, well, it's dangerous for starters, which is something you can't really act. And the recoil and stuff is all very specific, and the face you make when the percussion comes off them. So that was all real. Most of the pyrotechnics were real as well, so bullets hitting walls and dust flying everywhere was all done in camera. But occasionally when it was too dangerous and stuff going too close to their heads, then we would do it as a CG thing, but I'd say it was like 98% real, most of it.
You know what? Fuck the small talk. Let's buy some guns, eh?
All right, step into my office.
Thanks to Ben Wheatley for those fantastic films and for speaking to us on those occasions. I'm Ben Eshmade. You've been listening to an archive edition of Nothing Concrete, the Barbican podcast, here to inspire more people to discover and love the arts with weekly episodes of archive finds and theme series. Subscribe to Nothing Concrete on Acast, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts. And if you can, leave us a review to help us get the word out.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.